I'm longing to see. I hope that he turns out to be someone who'll watch over me. I'm a little babe who's lost in the wood. I know I could always be good to one who'll watch over me. Although he may not be the man some girls think of as
hello, listeners. This is David Blakesley welcoming you to A Safe Place. Yeah, this is a safe place to have conversations about movies, about the Criterion Collection, in the original order of its chronological release. We're talking about all those films. And here we are in the fall of 1971, landing on Henry Jaglom's A Safe Place. This is part of the BBS, America Lost and Found, the BBS story box set. A pretty impressive artifact from Criterion about 10 years ago, maybe a little less than 10 years. I think they released this at the end of 2010, and here we are in the early portion of 2020. This is spine number 548, and I'll just kind of kick things off by saying this is probably the one film that's the most crapped upon of any that are included in that set. However, we're not here to do crapping. We're here to do some thoughtful analysis and discussion, because this is, after all, a safe place. And to join me in my analysis and reflection, a couple familiar voices to people who've been following along, including my founding partner, Jordan Esso. How are you doing, Jordan?
I'm doing very good. How are you, David?
Very good. Yes, you and I go back to episode one of this series. You and I also did the Ingmar Bergman, The Touch, with your friend and noted director, Norman Buckley. That was a great conversation. It's been a while. So I think that last June is when we did that. And then I was out your way in California in July of last year. And then you and I were on the kind of year-end wrap-up best of 2019 with Criterion Cast regular crew members there.
Yes.
How's life going for you these days?
Oh, very good. Yeah. I'm glad we're still enjoying some colder winter temperatures here. I'm excited for, hopefully, let's say, fingers crossed, good things to happen in November.
Okay. Well, we're looking ahead already. Let's not wish this year away too much. But yeah, we do have an interesting journey as a society and as individuals within that society between now and, I presume you're thinking about Election Day, or are you talking about
Indeed.
The big Criterion box set?
For no, I'm I mean, both are good, right? Both are good.
Sure. We all hope for the best, absolutely. And joining me already, maybe you've heard that giggle there, Derek Power. Derek, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty well, thank you.
Yeah, it's been a little while. I think we talked about, Donkey Skin, and we did Jacques Tati's Trafic months ago.
Yep.
And life's going all right for you these days, my friend?
It's still going. I mean, I've been having a full plate for the past year or so. One thing I've been working on is, I've been working on an MBA, so that's been taking up a lot of time.
Oh yeah.
I'm still doing music. Or at least trying to do it. Actually, one big music thing I've been doing is I've been working as an apprentice over at Plaid Dog Recording Studio in Boston.
Oh yeah, that's right. That's right. Mm-hmm.
So that's been going on, and then I've been trying to do my own stuff as much as I can whenever I can. So it's just been busy but productive, and I think I'm starting to see some fruits of my labor starting to pay off. So that's also good.
It is that long-term investment in time and toil and tears that sometimes requires a bit of input before we start to see the results. So I definitely wish you all the best, and be sure to send me links to any updated projects, both of you. I know you're both in the creative arts in your own ways, and definitely want to give listeners a chance to connect with whatever you're doing, whatever you wish to promote. So maybe we can maybe talk a little bit more about that when we wrap things up here. But let's get to the subject at hand. I've already done a little bit of an introduction to it. Henry Jagalom. This was not a name that meant a whole lot to me up until just recently when I started doing my homework and studying the background of this film. But A Safe Place was, as it was already said, part of the BBS, box set, and part of this little eruption, I guess you could say, that happened within American cinema in the late 60s, early 70s. Of course, a lot of this was triggered by the monumental success of Easy Rider and, the money that it made and the creative opportunities that it opened up for independent filmmakers to pursue their own idiosyncratic visions of what the cinema could do and say to this emerging generation. So, Derek, let me just ask for you to kind of get us into the conversation about the film itself. You and I talked about Drive, He Said, several months ago. That was the most recent foray into this big box set. What is your kind of opening take on A Safe Place?
I've been thinking about that for the past week or so, just getting into it. And I think for the most part, I think it's really good. What's really striking to me is just how to put this, the sort of world that it creates. I mean, so A Safe Place is, if we were to really boil it down, there's a lot more to it, but if we're really boiling down, is you're seeing the thought process of this woman who goes by you find out she goes by two different names. Presumably her birth name is Susanna, and then the name that she seems to like or adopt is Noah. So, but she goes by both, or she's been addressed as by both names. And what you're seeing through the film is sort of her thought process, particularly as she interacts with one man named Fred, and the name slips by me, like, who plays him. And by the way, Philip Proctor. Mm-hmm. And Susanna is played by the very lovely Tuesday Weld. But anyways, so it's sort of as she's interacting with him, you're also kind of seeing sort of, as in addition to seeing the conversations and the interactions, but it's also the way it's shot and the way it's edited, you kind of get the sense of you're kind of seeing more of her thinking than what's on the surface. Like, so there's a lot more things going on underneath the surface.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, good. So that kind of gets us into the basic setup. Jordan, let me ask a little bit of your reaction here, because I think of you as somebody who's involved in a form of independent cinema. Of course, yeah. The industry has evolved quite a bit since these times. What interested you in being part of this conversation, and what do you think about A Safe Place?
Well, I'm really a huge fan of almost everything in this BBS box set, and I couldn't be here for the discussion that you guys had on Drive, He Said, but I'm glad I'm here this morning, because I thought you guys were fairly mean to that film last time. And
well, refresh my memory, because it's been a while.
Didn't think I was as meaning, but anyways, that's just
there,
my take.
I think there was no, I mean, I'm just making light, but there was a consensus that there was something kind of fractured and not really too mature in the way that story was put together, that there were scenes that didn't kind of go anywhere, or that there were character personality traits that weren't justified. I really love Drive, He Said. I also really love this film. Like, I'll just put that out there in front of, so that I can start the defense of this film immediately.
Preemptive defense.
That's why I wanted to talk about it. Just, I thought, well, if there is this kind of prevailing mood that this film doesn't really, I don't know, accomplish what it sets out to do, or doesn't do it in a comprehensible way, like, I really don't feel that way. I remember being on the discussion with you, David, and was it Trevor? I think it was Jonathan Lobinger. We talked about Easy Rider. Mm-hmm. And I like that film. I think a lot of people maybe feel that film as impactful as it has been, its legacy really is that it started something, but that it doesn't hold up on its own merits necessarily as much. Time hasn't been as favorable to the way that film ages. I think that's fair. And overall, I would say this is a much stronger film. I mean, I think Drive, he said, is a stronger film. I think the films that are most talked about in this set, Easy Rider and Last Picture Show, are to my taste, the weaker entries in this collection because of their conventionality. Well, I wouldn't call Easy Rider conventional, but Last Picture Show, certainly. This film really attempts something prismatic and nonlinear in a way that I really enjoy. The film's really about escape. And so this thing that Derek was talking about, where we're mostly seeing things through Susan's eyes, Noah's eyes, and that this journey we take through her perspective, it is sort of disjointed, but that feels true to the way that people actually experience life, that memory and wishes and wish fulfillment exist in simultaneity with the linear form that their actual life, structures. So we have this person that there's a lostness about her. You know, she has these two lovers that, again, Derek was describing. We've got, the one kind of more sober, more linear guy. And then we have the more adventurous, dangerous lover played by Jack Nicholson named Mitch. Neither of these guys fulfill her, really. This is a person, the lead character played by Tuesday Weld. There's a yearning in her and a curiosity about the world, but there's also this sense that she has settled on a certain worldview that almost closes her off to people. You see her almost foreclosing connection, especially with the Phil Proctor character Fred. So here she is, and she has imaginary friends, the Orson Welles character I read as the childhood imaginary friend, the magician in the park, the one with the gifts, the one with the kindness, the one with the, endless the understanding. And so she wants, just like a lot of the films in this set, she wants a kind of freedom that she can't quite define. And I do think this film is about escape, and I think the suicide is really it's really kind of the thing that the film tells you is one avenue for that. It's maybe even society tells us that suicide is a final escape route, for some people. But along the way, this sense that the world doesn't get you, that your own life perhaps doesn't even get you, and that spending time with other people and reaching out to other people and not finding that satisfying mirror, that you end up being in some ways the best company you can find, but that maybe you're broken, and so you are restless and incomplete company at best, and at worst you're dangerous company. And that sounds pretty dour. The film doesn't really present as dour, especially Weld's performance. It's very light, it's very playful, it's very childlike. So the two poles of this film are really that the darkness of dissatisfaction with life combined with this really compelling sense that life is an adventure and filled with, imaginative possibilities. And it's really quite a beautiful film.
There's a lot there to respond to. Derek, I'm going to give you a chance. Do you want to, pick up on anything that Jordan threw out there? I've got a few thoughts of my own, but I'll give you the first shot at it.
The thing that I definitely like about it, and I will admit that sometimes the worst that I feel with this film is just more ambivalence. I definitely have tremendous respect for what it was doing. And since you mentioned Drive, he said, I think it's much stronger in what it's much stronger in what it set out to do. It was also very clear as to what it wanted to do. So I think that comes through very well. There was no doubt that this is what the film is. And it's very bold and unapologetic in what it's doing. And I have a soft spot for films that tend to be very atypical or unusual or go off the beaten path and such. So, and the thing that this is definitely a film that affirms what I like about cinema in general, is that it gives you the ability to make a world the way you see it and then allow somebody else to see it. Granted, this is what all art does. I mean, you know, when you make a painting, that's, it does the same thing. When you take a photograph and you do additional things to it, that's also what you're doing. But the thing that makes cinema so powerful is because you're seeing a rapid succession of images, and combined with sound, it makes it more immersive and real. Like, you can kind of respond to it more immediately than you would with like a static painting or a photograph or even a piece of music, which also operates through time. So, but yeah, I liked that it in revealing kind of the inner world, you kind of get a sense of sort of what she thinks and what she feels and how it just really just how she sees things, and which can then produce a kind of empathy where you can kind of see her brokenness and her wounds and her, like, all of that. You, it's just kind of all on sort of full display, a kind of, I guess this is an appropriate phrase to use, psychological nudity. You know, there's, it's a, you know, very much, you know, she's very open in this film, which paradoxically she also kind of holds herself really tight in her interactions, particularly with Fred and with Mitch. By the way, I didn't mention Mitch earlier is because I had thought, the thought occurred to me that there's an implication that Mitch may not actually be real, but more like an idealized idea of like what she wants in a man. But at any rate, but it's like, it's all presented. It's all taken in right then and there. And just in a very, assured and unapologetic way. So,
yeah. Okay. I think unapologetic. Absolutely. Assured. I think you could definitely see that this is a first time director who's still working out the vocabulary of cinema,
yes,
and how it works, and how it communicates to a more general audience. But you know, I will just say this, sitting down and just plopping it down, let's pop in a video, let's watch what's on this disc, may not work for a lot of viewers. That was probably my first impression, because I just sort of sat down, and I'll say I was probably slightly biased by my knowledge of the negative reviews and the kind of dismissal that I kind of already referenced earlier on, that this is not a well-reviewed film. And it really wasn't until my second viewing, and then actually starting to get into some of the supplements, the brief Henry Jaglom, like a 6-minute intro, mm-hmm, essay, and then the commentary track. And I did a little bit of the 1971 interview between him and Peter Bogdanovich and Molly Haskell, which was pretty fascinating, but just, you know, kind of time ran out on me to get the whole thing in. I did a lot of reading this morning about Henry Jaglom. He's had a very long and really very productive career, but I'll be honest, until this week, that name did not really mean a whole lot to me. So we can maybe talk about him a little bit more, but I guess I do want to focus my introductory thoughts on Tuesday Weld.
Yeah.
She is a incredibly beautiful woman. Her face is featured very prominently in the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Derek, you talked about psychological nudity, and I was actually somewhat surprised that there was no physical nudity here. She just didn't go there, and maybe Henry didn't ask her to go there to exploit that particular angle. But she's a really compelling presence visually, and even just the gaze of her eyes, the expressions of her face, and that little monologue where she kind of laments that her eyes don't have that inner light. It's like, woman, what are you talking about? You are hypnotic, you know, or what do you, yeah. But capitalizing on the fact, and really, I think making this film a bit of a reflection on the life experience of a, you know, almost supremely beautiful woman and her experience in this world and the kind of unique pressures and opportunities and, you know, both advantages and disadvantages that come with being the type of person that she is and how other people, you know, relate, a pretty important piece of what was happening in this film and what Henry Jaglom is trying to capture. He mentions that the character of Susan slash Noah is about one third Karen Black, who was yep. his girlfriend at the time that he wrote the stage play version of this story. Tuesday kind of brought her own element into it, and she'd had quite a career, and maybe can we talk a little bit about that. And then there was some of Henry Jaglom himself that kind of informed the personality of this character. So to me, mm-hmm. that really became sort of the magnet for me, this contemplation of a life experience of somebody who was as physically attractive as Tuesday Weld, where you see the Fred character, and I'm already early on in the film thinking, Fred, you're a bit out of your league here, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
But, you know, what do you guys think about that as an angle of entry here, that this is a film that really is a woman's picture in a way, but not in the traditional weepy soap opera, you know, melodramatic way, but it's a...
Yeah, no Douglas Sirk or anything
no,
like that.
No, it's about being a woman in the youth culture of the late 60s, early 70s.
Yeah. Well, I think the actor, Phil Proctor, is also sort of out of his depth mm-hmm. here. I think he's being asked to do something that's a lot less demanding. But, you know, I actually didn't make that much time to think about Tuesday's physical beauty. I agree with you. You know, she is striking and her eyes are definitely vibrant. And there's a way in which I was just so distracted by how brilliantly she grounds this character. There's a temptation, I think, a lot of actors might see a character like Susan slash Noah, who is, you know, earthy and spontaneous and very fanciful. I mean, there's something sort of outlandish about some of the, you know, playful ways in which she insists, you know, are the most important things about her world. And an actor will take that character and really kind of play it. I'm using my hands like you can see them, like up here, you know, like, and she roots it so fundamentally in the emotional truths of that character. It blows me away. I mean, there's the more technical side of like the romance with which she says her words, like the music of it, the way she uses pauses, the way she stays so focused in what she's thinking while the other person is talking, not in a way that dismisses what they're saying, but in this sort of this like ardent commitment to her point of view is not going to change, even though she might listen. She's just sort of like in it, really waiting for her turn to talk more. And this rebellious quality of being so rooted in this fantasy world, really, I don't think I've ever seen anything like it. I've seen the film now twice, but both times I just found that the most mesmerizing aspect of the film. There's that one scene that I think has been used as the, you know, as the trailer scene. Very strange to use it in that way, but it's because it's so fantastic when she's talking about how would you describe it? The linguistics of telephone numbers, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The prefix,
the numbers turning into the first two letters and all of that, yeah.
Right, and the exhilaration of like when you get a really good one, you know, and this is such frivolous nonsense, and she makes me feel like it's the most important thing because she thinks it's the most important thing.
Yeah, well, yeah, she has this attachment to, you know, childhood impressions, the little games that we play. I mean, when she's talking about her memories of flying as a child, I mean, that really kind of, you know, triggered me to remember very vivid dreams I had as like a 3, 4, 5 year old of, excuse me, of flying, where it felt so real. Like I would be dreaming that I was on a swing set in my playground at school, wherever I was, you know, living at the time. And all of a sudden I would just sort of let go and I would be up in the air and I would be looking down and I'd be seeing these landscapes, and it was like being in a plane or a helicopter. I mean, it was so vivid, and her little monologue about that childhood experience and lamenting the fact that she knew that she could fly, but she just can't remember how she did it anymore. Wow, that was very powerful to me because I could relate to that.
Yeah, that's Karen Black's memory, and she still feels very strongly about that. Like she actually did fly, so that's still very effective for her. So
yeah, the power and the vividness of dreams that feel every bit as true as, you know, the consensus reality that we all sort of inhabit, and we have shared common memories and those laws of physics, those things that, you know, explain why certain things happen. Even the little the seance scene, or the, you know, the whatever you want to call it, the spiritualism of moving the glass,
the makeshift Ouija board.
Yeah, exactly. And then here comes Fred to kind of, you know, Mr. Buzzkill kind of,
right.
Pretty, but you know that, and you know, that was the thing. There were those moments where, you know, she's gotten herself into this relationship with this guy, and again, a woman of her charm and beauty has presumably gone through many relationships already, but she's going to give this new guy a chance. You know, she was sitting there at the cafe table, just looking over the pond in the park, and this guy comes up and makes chit chat with her, and she's like, okay, I'll give him a go. But after they've kind of run through a few cycles, you can just sort of see her feeling of recognition. Oh, here we go again. This isn't really going to turn into something. And right. Yet he continues to pursue her, and he's just not going to let it go until it just becomes blatantly obvious to him through her own actions and decisions that, you know, this is not going to be the long-term relationship of your life. That's maybe what you're thinking. That's what you're hoping. And again, it's just that, you know, that sheer erotic attraction that I think she exerts, really almost not through any fault of her own. It's just her being who she is, and she has to deal with it as a result. And you know, what a toll that must take.
Well, I think, you know, she uses these men, whether Jack Nicholson's character Mitch is a fantasy or not. And I think Derek makes a good point that he very well could be. She uses these men as avenues for self-expression. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, you know, Fred might be disappointed that this woman's not going to be a serious relationship, much less the love of his life. But I'm not even sure that's the experiment she's running. It's not even
she's not trying to. Yeah. I think she's just going about her life. Yeah.
She just wants to be able to express all the eccentricities that she has within herself, but she needs a sounding board for that.
Mm-hmm. Mm, yeah. Yes.
And so she can just be in relationship with people, but without all of the baggage, you know, sexual, emotional, psychological, controlling, ownership, obligations. I mean, that's the thing, you know, she just doesn't really want to have to, you know, be hooked in and at somebody else's beck and call.
Yeah. Or have to compromise, mm-hmm. have to change who she is. She wants to reach her full potential, you know, and I think we can all relate to that. It's terrible from Fred's point of view, but from her point of view, he's somewhat disposable in her journey of self-realization. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So let's talk about this film as it connected to the larger culture then and maybe even now. I mean, I would dare say that this is probably a lesser known work out of the set and out of films from this era. Again, its reputation does not seem to demand a lot of attention. We've already talked about Easy Rider and The Last Picture Show, which will be the next episode of this podcast, as maybe a little bit more conventional crowd pleasers. Their grammar, their approach, the storylines that they encapsulate, you know, just kind of hit that sweet spot for a large number of viewers who don't really have to adjust themselves. They will settle into something that is already somewhat familiar to them. And so there's that pleasure of reinforcement or of maybe a slightly different variation on themes and angles that they've already explored before. This really is a very challenging film. And I think to some people, and maybe myself, if I had not been somewhat compelled to dig deeper and to really try to figure out what's going on here, I can see the case for just sort of setting this one aside and saying, it doesn't work for me. This guy's a little bit too full of himself, or, you know, the ending didn't really pay off, or there's just not that you know, easy entree if you're not looking to be challenged, or if you don't just naturally, you know, sync with Henry Jaglom's vibe here.
You know, the way you put that, it kind of forces me to think, well, you know, in a way, maybe when you make a film like this, Jaglom is essentially, you know, the Susan character, mm-hmm. using the audience for his exploration.
Yeah, you know, yeah.
the audience becomes a surrogate for her men. But, you know, like, people aren't very generous to films like this in general. And I don't think it's an aspect of even the time that it comes from or the fact that this was his first film. You know, people shit on post-Tree of Life Terrence Malick films, mm-hmm. like To the Wonder of Night of Cups, mm-hmm. because they are similarly kind of amorphous. And it's just right. because that type of filmmaking does not have broad appeal.
Right. It's like a stream of consciousness literature where, you know, you're just into yeah. the mind of a character. And unless you feel some kind of affinity or kinship with that character, it's just like, you know, I'm just going to read something that speaks more directly to me or doesn't force me to work as hard. And I think ultimately that's to the loss of the viewer who might, you know, pass this one over or might just brush it off. Because I think there is something interesting and very vital to be found here. You know, and let me ask you just a little bit about Henry Jaglom's, his, you know, discovery even after the, you know, the release of this film and, you know, and learning how it was going to be received very poorly by the mainstream critical establishment. And yet this kind of second life that the film found when it was endorsed by Anais Nin and, you know, connected with an audience of younger women in particular in the early 70s who found themselves or a reflection of their experience in this film. It seems that Jaglom, and again, I've never seen any of his other works, but that's the course he pursued. Here we are, three white guys talking about this film from an appreciative and respectful angle. But I do wonder, what are your thoughts about Jaglom as a male feminist filmmaker? Is that a tag that's fair to place upon him? And are either of you familiar with any of the things that he did after this one?
Apart from his commentary track and then just looking at the IMDb listing, I've not seen any of his films after A Safe Place. But again, I treat it to, you know, like with artists in general, you know, we all have, you know, anyone who engages in making art, they all have their fascinations and you just kind of pursue those and then you make whatever you want to make, and then hopefully other people will be into it as well. It's interesting, Joy, that you mentioned post Tree of Life Malick, because I'm also a very fervent defender of that output.
Nice.
So it's because like I like what he does, and I can see past just the superficial. Oh, you just have this great cinematography, and oh, you have this sort of free associative, free form editing, and all the things that people don't like about the films after The Tree of Life. But I could tell that there's something more going on to it besides just what's on the surface. And going back to A Safe Place, I said before that at worst, I feel ambivalent to it. And it's mostly just because I don't always connect with Susan and, Susanna, or just various little details in general. It's like it just doesn't speak for me, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't speak for somebody else. So I understand that it's just not my cup of tea, and I don't begrudge anybody if they happen to like it. And I think it's great that there's films out there, and I hope that there's more films could be made out there that can appeal to people, connect to people, whatever it happens to be.
So to answer the question, David, I'd say first, I don't think actually we need to apologize for being, you know, straight white guys. Like, our opinions are just as valid,
right.
Especially considering this director is a straight white guy. Mm-hmm. In terms of the way that his point of view fits into the folds of gender politics and feminism, I also listened to the commentary track, and I think, you know, he had some really very interesting things to say about femininity and masculinity, like detached from gender, just as, you know, the connection that he saw between artistic creation and femininity, and the way that his mother had raised him in a way that did not create strong walls, you know, that there's a permissiveness there for him to be able to explore, if we want to see it in binary terms, both aspects of his personality. And as far as an ISNN, you know, taking this film and championing it as a vehicle for feminist discussion, I mean, I think that's there, you know. I think
that it's powerful, and yeah, I think her essay was in praise of sensitive men or something of that sort, you know, and and I think that there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's a fantastic tribute to Jaglom's innovation and originality that he was able to, you know, really charter off into this course of filmmaking, and you know, kind of growing from his theatrical experience and the Actors Studio and the Method, and as he very readily admits, a very privileged upbringing, to say let's do something different, let's do something unique here that connects with an audience in ways that maybe there's not too many other people in this world or in this industry who can do what I do, so let's just go for it.
It's great that he took that on, because you could be easily discouraged with something like A Safe Place, and you see all the reviews like, if this is what it's going to be, I don't want to have any part of it.
Back to the theater, you know, just
To the theater, back to doing something else. But the fact that he wasn't discouraged, and certainly he found people who did encourage him to do that, that he was able to have the career, you know, long after that, to everyone, I guess, to all of our mutual surprise, like, oh, he still kept making films long after that. So that's great that he was able to do that. Still was able to do that.
Sorry, Derek.
No, that's it.
I did try two of his more recent films. This was a bit of a, I wanted to squeeze him in before we talked about him, because I, like you, David, had only seen this one. So I would say I'll tiptoe into these observations, because they're incomplete at best. I put on The M Word for a handful of minutes, and then I put on Queen of the Lot for a handful of minutes. And I found them both to seem sort of visually on the less luxurious side. Maybe a good a good tool for discussing the advantages of actual, like, celluloid versus digital. And then the acting felt a little tinny, and the absence of any experimental qualities that I could pick up on in the first handful of minutes made me set them aside. That doesn't mean I won't return to them, but I was surprised that there was no immediate relationship that I could see to this film. Especially considering, from what I understand about his career, like, I think there's a certain amount of self-financing, or at the very least low-budget independent financing, so that he can maintain creative control.
Yeah, he's always had absolute final cut on all of his films. He's been productive through the, you know, it took him quite a few years, I think about 5 years, before he could get financing for his second film, which was also produced by Bert Schneider. A film called Track, starring Dennis Hopper. There's a pretty interesting trailer there. But I'll put a link in the show notes. Prime Video, or Amazon Prime, has quite a nice selection of films throughout his entire career that is, you know, gone into, you know, fairly recent years. He's up into his, I think, early 80s now. So, you know, he may not have a whole lot of work left ahead of him, but it seems like he's still out there doing stuff. I found an advertisement for acting workshops that he's led last year in 2019. So he's still going at it, you know, a true indie artist and an original. I've also got a couple of links from the LA Times and Hollywood Reporter. So he's been a presence. He's been very active in that community, but he's certainly been doing it on his own terms, which is, you know, partly very admirable. I mean, what a bold and, you know, self-reliant career he's forged for himself. So more power to him. However, there is an aspect here where, you know, if I had not watched the film with the commentary track, if I had not, gotten into some of the other background material, I'm not sure I would have bonded with this film to the extent that I feel it now, because given, giving him the opportunity to explain himself, to take us into some of the interiority of what he was doing in this film, even those scenes shot in his parents' apartment. Well, I had no idea that any of this was as personal or as heartfelt. It was just kind of like, oh, this is an interesting environment that we're in here. But now that it's, obviously so self-referential, it takes on new dimensions. And as you begin to identify with the artist and sort of see the world through his eyes a bit, now I can appreciate stuff like that. But, most of the time I go to the movies, I don't need like a liner notes and commentary track just to get into it, So did he overplay his hand a little bit? I mean, I think that's a fair assessment to make. Doesn't mean that it's, it condemns the film. And once you know these things and can factor that into your appraisal of the work, then it becomes, I think, that much richer. So I don't know. It's a balance both ways. But he made a very personal film that really fulfilled his own ideals and ambitions, and very indirectly invited us, the rest of us, along for the ride.
Can we talk about that Central Park West apartment though for a second?
Sure. it's an amazing place. Absolutely.
Oh yeah. My God! Like, the first time I saw it, I was like, that's a Degas painting. That's Chagall. Oh my God. Yeah. That's Renoir.
These are not prints. These are the real deal.
These are original works. Right, and right. Like, those are Modigliani. Like, that looks like, I'm pretty sure, gosh, that kind of also looks like a Seurat or a Cezanne. Like, the amount of expressionist, impressionist, and surrealist works in that apartment. And I was like, what is this place? And then when I was listening to the commentary track a couple days ago, it's his parents' place. He grew up there. So in the film, it's his character Fred's apartment. And I guess in a sort of diaristic instinct, he wanted to include it in the film so that he would have the memory of filming there and the document.
Yeah, the preservation of this situation that he maybe knew was not going to last much longer with his parents getting up there in years or whatever. But you think, boy, Fred, if you've come from that kind of background, you should be a much more interesting person than that. Right?
So true. And, Jaglom self-describes himself as like, I had a comfortable upbringing. It's like, I think you and I have different definitions of the word comfortable.
Yeah, yeah.
The outrageous price of just a place like that overlooking the park, even in the 60s, and then all of these paintings, and then clearly they're sort of jet setting parents always on the run, always traveling. Wow. I mean, what a way to grow up.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you really are looking at sort of a different world. I mean, this is not exactly Whit Stillman's world, but not that far from it either, as far as the upper crust of New York society. It seems like Jaglom certainly has a bohemian streak running through this. He's not not an aristocrat by any means, especially the way that he, could have gone into any number of different directions with the kind of affluence that he was familiar with. But his parents were also into the arts and culture scene of New York City. They just happened to have a lot of wealth. And you're right, I think for a lot of us, that's like kind of a pipe dream to live that kind of a life, or to have all of these connections and all this access to brilliant, beautiful, creative people. I think Jaglom's pretty matter of fact. This is just how I've grown up. This is just the life I'm used to. So I'm kind of telling you about how it is from my perspective. So it is definitely a unique and interesting vantage point, as long as envy doesn't get the better of us.
Well, he doesn't apologize for it either. Right, in fact, if anything, he takes full advantage of it and kind of shares it. I mean, I think artists at their best, they kind of invest the best of themselves into their work, and then they share it, and then you kind of get, so everybody becomes all the more richer for having that. So
We haven't really talked a whole lot about Jack Nicholson. Let's go ahead and get into Jack Nicholson and his bit, and we can maybe touch on Orson Welles as well. They are both really, and again, even if you don't know who Henry Jaglom is, Tuesday Welles is an interesting character, but Jack Nicholson, everybody's got a take on Jack Nicholson. This seems like maybe a few days' work, a favor for a friend type of a thing. What do y'all make of Jack's contributions here?
Well, it's so hard to look back on early Jack Nicholson, knowing what he would do much later on, and certainly what he would be best known for, and you know, trying to reconcile the two. Like, for instance, him, like the one of the bedroom conversations he has with Susanna, he's talking about, you know, about murdering ex-lovers or something or something like that, and my little MST3K instinct kicked in and says, "You're auditioning for the job of the caretaker, aren't you?"
Yes.
It's like, damn it.
But, I guess, but he improvised that, right, Derek?
I think so, yeah.
Those lines were his contribution to that scene, because they had the script, but I guess Jaglom at a certain point realized, well, look, I have actors with really full interior lives of their own. They can actually flesh out aspects of these characters I haven't thought of. Let's have them improvise at times and just use the intention of the scene as the armature and then deliver great things like that, which really contributes great to the theme of escape and suicide and also selfishness.
And actually, I think this is of course the double-edged sword of having some well-known, even signature roles, is that you forget that, you know, Jack Nicholson through his career has been quite versatile. Like, he can do underplay just as much as kabuki over the top as well. So, and you get a little bit of that in A Safe Place. I mean, I think you get more of the, like, you get more subtlety, like when you get into The King of Marvin Gardens, for instance. Mm-hmm. And certainly moments in Five Easy Pieces.
Yep.
So A Safe Place is probably, I mean, there's, I think because you're dealing with someone's imagination and thought processes, it can get a little bit off kilter, but not too much. So I don't know. I like it. I mean, I think it certainly serves the character well, and it serves the film well for sure. So like, he doesn't need to be like front and center. He can be a good supporting player as well as being the front man in this case.
I wish he was in it a little bit more.
Departure is very abrupt. I mean, he literally does just disappear, you know.
Yeah, yeah. And also, when he first appeared, when you first see him, I would say, if we're gonna split hairs here, I think that's a minor quibble I'd have with the editing, is that he's seen like as a quick flash, and then you don't see him again for some time, and it feels, as a viewer, you're a little unmoored by that.
Yeah, he's like basically tonguing Tuesday Weld's neck. You know, like, what is this?
Yeah.
Kind of out of nowhere. And then it's like, what, another half hour before he actually makes a character entrance and you figure out who this guy is. So,
yeah. So that's a bit jarring. What did you think, David? Did you like his performance?
Oh, I did. I mean, I think, again, it's another way of challenging the audience. You've basically got two male archetypes, you know, the swaggery, aggressive, undependable, volatile, macho guy, and the steady, intelligent, sensitive, thoughtful, attentive man who's almost a little bit too accommodating, a little bit too safe, kind of drab, kind of boring, but, you know, a good, steady fellow, you know, whose heart is in the right place. And sort of the dilemma that the contemporary woman has to, deal with in terms of who does she find most attractive versus who does she find safer, you know. I think he's kind of engaging in some archetypes, you may even call them stereotypes there, but that is a point of access. I mean, I think there's a lot of stuff that happens in the kind of early to mid sections of the film that can leave a lot of what we've been sort of, you know, maybe summarizing as conventional viewers a little bit befuddled. But once that whole dynamic emerges, that here's the ex-boyfriend dropping in at 4 o'clock in the morning to just sort of say, "Hey, babe, what's happening?" and not expecting to find that she's got another boyfriend who's already there, and how do they negotiate this? I mean, to me, that was that was pretty visceral. I think most any of us can find ourselves somewhere in that equation, and I think even in the commentary tracks, Henry Jaglom says we should be able to relate to all three of the positions, you know. The person who's maybe genuinely, you know, torn between two lovers, to invoke that old 70s chestnut, and as well as the people who are, you know, making the move and people who are on the outside looking in saying, what's going on here, you know. So to me, that was actually a pretty good grounding of the film in a very tangible conflict that I think we all can relate to in some way or another. And I think Jack pulls it off very well. I mean, he's not just this maniacal sex fiend who's just coming in for a quick midnight quickie. He recognizes, hey, if I was that other guy, I'd be pretty pissed and I got to step out, you know? I thought there was some good subtlety to all of that. And the fact that they just kind of gave him the exit line and the opening line and said, you fill in the middle. That was some pretty cool improvisation. And you just sort of see acting given its showcase, which I think is another great aspect of cinema. It's not just reciting your lines, it's creating the characters and bringing this idea to life.
The way he complicates,
it's living a moment.
Exactly. And that's, I'm sure, how that idea occurred to him, like, oh well, okay, this is actually, his resolve is going to be very complicated at this point, because this boyfriend is, in his attempts to stay in the room, is not just an obstacle to my physical goals. He's now an obstacle to my mental goals, because I feel sorry for him and I see myself in him. Yeah, it was pretty good. Mm. Pretty good. You want to move in to talk about Orson Welles?
Of course. I mean, he's another pretty big name, and this is a kind of a fascinating interim part of his career. One of the reviews I read said it's kind of an entree into the F for Fate character, which I guess is maybe a couple of years down the line, but this is definitely where Orson's a bit of wandering in the wilderness. Well, he did a lot of that over the years, but you know, he had struck up this friendship with Henry Jagulum and was willing to, Henry Jagulum kind of gave him a cold call and did a hard pitch and persuaded Welles to get into this project, simply based on the idea that he could do his magic tricks and that he could just kind of create his own identity in this film. It was, obviously anybody who's into Orson Welles, you got to check this one out, because it's not maybe a major part of his oeuvre, but it's still Orson at a key moment, and you get some pretty cool Orson clips in there. So I was pretty amused by his contributions, for sure.
My favorite anecdote that Jagulum shared was some helpful advice that Orson Welles gave him in the making of the film, where before Jagulum was insisting on certain shots, and everybody in the crew was telling him that they're not going to cut, or that this doesn't make sense. And there was this initial resistance, you know, because of that, because the director wants one way, and then the crew is looking at this, you know, more traditionally, like, this is just not going to work. And he brought this up with Orson one day, and he tells them, you know, and Orson advised him to just tell them, if somebody comes up to you like that, tell them that you're doing a dream sequence.
Yeah, I like that.
And it's like, well, why is, just tell them that. It's like, okay. So the next day this came up again. And so Jagulum takes his advice, and then all of a sudden the dynamic just completely changes. The cinematographer's like, oh, what if we do it from this angle instead of that? Or what if we bring this in? And everybody started to like chime in, and there was a lot more receptive. And so Jagulum's really impressed by this, and later talked to Orson about it. And Orson says, well, when you say, these people are professional, and they're accustomed to making films in a particular way, and that it has to make logical narrative sense. Like, everything has to like fit together. But when you're talking about dreams, that's when you're the most free and you're the most open. And like, it just seems like anything is possible. So as soon as you invite it, as soon as you say that this is a dream sequence, suddenly everybody's like, oh, we can do this, we can do that. And it doesn't, and then logical consistency and narrative consistency just gets thrown out the window, and now you're able to put more of yourself, more interesting things, whatever it is. So it ends up being more inviting for everybody. And I thought that was really interesting. It's like one of those neat little object lessons about filmmaking, and just, I think, just probably just making art in general. and maybe even life in general too.
yeah, you can certainly extend it. But yeah, that's a you know, trick of the trade that Orson had picked up along the way, and sharing it with a young, perhaps kindred spirit. You know, this young man who's making movies his own way and doing his own kind of uncompromised stuff. I'm sure Orson could see a bit of himself.
Which is very relatable.
Yeah, well, very much so. And you know, how Orson had, you know, been forced to compromise when the studio system was at the height of its powers, really. And now here's a new chapter being written and new opportunities where, you know, filmmakers could really just do their own thing without having to be, you know, quite so bolted down to the conventional wisdom or even studio expectations that this movie has to, you know, gross a certain, you know, percentage above the investment in order to be deemed a success. Jordan, I kind of want to maybe get a little bit of your thoughts. If you want to talk about Orson Welles, or if you just want to talk about your own experience with filmmaking, in, you know, in your own career, you've done screenwriting, you've done some directing, certainly acting. How did you relate to that whole piece of this project and how you saw it coming together or the end product of it?
Yeah, I probably have a couple words about Orson as well, but in terms of, you know, editing a piece that does have a stream of consciousness intent, and having shot a lot of material and then, you know, realizing what does and does not form the whole that you're looking for in the editing process is something that I definitely relate to. You know, I've made several experimental shorts and, you know, some of these things, I think result from, you know, that axiom that, you know, don't try to make the film that you thought you're going to make, make the film that you have. And also, if you're open and spontaneous, you end up filming stuff that you weren't looking for. You react to something that's happening as it happens, even if you're not working at that time, you know, you just happen to have your equipment with you and something's happening around you and it's inspiring and you document it. And then you search for, it's almost intuitively, you search for the way that that event, that footage, whatever it was that inspired you, maybe it was just the quality of the light. How does that, what conversation takes place between that footage and this other stuff that you're working on? Because those relationships are often there even when you don't know that they're there, because it's the state of mind that you're in. Like when you're working on a project, you're always sort of immersed in it, even when you're doing your taxes, right? So that process of active discovery of thinking about, you know, there is a unity here and it's my job to discover it. It's like the material knows, I just have to somehow peel back the cover and learn what the material that I've made already understands about itself. Mm. So when I see a film like this and I see how freely it's been listened to, I relate to that. And the idea of these shots that Jaglom drops in to comment on the scene, and it just sort of, it may be a scene that we then revisit later, like when we first see the Jack Nicholson character, and then, like you were saying, later we revisit those interactions and then understand the context of it. Other times in this film, there's a shot that is sort of like a widow. It just sort of is there and is never allowed to be anything else than that one small visit. I think that that's a powerful way to tell a story. I think after the MTV era of you know, small filmmaking, some of those ideas don't feel as fresh or as interesting just because they're kind of played out. But as an instinct for image making and for narrative structure, That's something I've always found like really exciting.
Yeah, projecting his own childhood, you know, home movies onto Tuesday Weld's face. I mean, you know, there's a lot that's unexplained when you first see that, but if you're paying attention, if you're really kind of, you know, fixing your gaze on what's happening and not getting distracted by devices or letting your mind wander, there's a lot of really interesting visual stuff. And I'm certainly, you know, as you say, kind of, we're maybe a little bit jaded or overexposed to some of the, you know, innovations and cinematic, you know, kind of avant-garde techniques that he was at least trying to use. These kind of pull away elevated crane shots or even helicopter shots, you know, there's a certain gratuitousness that you could, you know, tag on some of those effects. But, you know, to me, that's ambition. It's creative instinct. It's playfulness. That's saying, let's strive for something. Let's just kind of, you know, launch ourselves out there and see what fits and what sticks. And, you know, Jagiellon himself, again, in the commentary, talks about just taking the different bits of film that he's created and putting them together. You know, it may sound grandiose, but he's putting together sort of a symphony of visuals and audio elements as well. Did you want to talk about Orson Welles before we get into like soundtrack? Because that's another pretty key element here.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about Orson just to say that I think it's worth asking all of us, like, does his contribution to this film work? Not as an actor, you know, not as a presence, mm-hmm. but apparently that character of the magician was not in the stage play.
Right, right.
So it was really out of an instinct of Jagiellon's to want Orson Welles to be in his film. Like, who wouldn't, mm-hmm. you know? So he appealed to this knowledge that he already had about Orson Welles, that Orson Welles liked magicians, thought of himself as one, enjoyed that whole showmanship of being a magician, and so pitched that. You know, like, you know, you can be a magician in character in the film, not really even knowing what that would be.
Right.
Now, so we only see Orson Welles, they probably shot for, you know, one day, right? So we only see Orson Welles in Central Park. He performs some magic tricks with like a levitating ball. He has a secret magic box that he gives her at a certain point. He has her, you know, reach into his coat pocket and get gifts. And he's this sort of nurturing presence. But I think structurally, if I could go ahead and, you know, forward my thoughts on, mm-hmm. on his contribution to the film, I think structurally it works. It ends up working quite well. And I'm sure that's because of the discoveries in the editing room. But it's also thematically, it made sense that, you know, the very first words of the film, or the very first word actually, is remember. Mm-hmm. It's yeah. also the last word of the film.
Right.
At the beginning of the film, it's the magician's line. Remember, like it's a command, like it's a device, you know, try to do this. The second line of the film is Susan's character, and this is all voiceover, I think, against Black, and she says, "When can I leave?" Which also is foreshadowing the end of the film, when finally she says, "Remember." And so there's just this thread of she used to fly when she was a child, and now she can't because she can't remember. If only she could remember, she could fly again. So then we keep revisiting these visuals of levitating objects in the park. Often she's, you know, the audience for these tricks, so she's involved in the fantasy of levitation throughout the story. We don't constantly need to be reminded of that through dialogue. And then there's the secret magic box that she has that she tries to explain to her lover. He's supposed to help her with it somehow. It's not explained, but at the very least, he's supposed to, you know, be a good warden of it and don't look inside. It's her secret box. And at the end, you know, she goes up to the rooftop and she opens it, and this also pulls on this other thread of like there being nothing inside recurs. There's nothing inside. She thinks he's lying, but then somehow it does work. She remembers, and with some of those overhead shots you were describing, helicopter shots, like we get this sense of like we're levitating with her, like we are also escaping. And I think all of that makes the Orson Welles material like really work. He's also, disappearance is another form of escape,
right.
And he's constantly trying to make, he says, if only I could make something disappear. And he's, in maybe a little bit of a heavy-handed metaphor, he is trying to make zoo animals that are caged disappear. Mm-hmm. And he tells us, you know, like the camel is dreaming of sand and the sea lions are dreaming of oceans. And of course, Susan is dreaming of the sky. That all feels maybe a little bit heavy-handed, but I think overall, I like the way it fits together. It's not too clean. I think it's especially when you're dealing with a narrative that is so experimental, you can actually hit the nail on the head a little harder, because what you're doing is you're giving the audience traction.
Yeah, even I think it even uses some of Orson's you know, self-acknowledged pomposity to its advantage. The story of the city that contains all cities, and then there's a room there that has all rooms, and then there's a man who, you know, does nothing but laugh. You know, it's just like this kind of, you know, cosmic absurdity in a certain sense. It's almost like a very condensed version of The Immortal Story, another kind of film that's written off as, you know, grotesque self-indulgence on the part of Orson Welles. Yeah. But he has a flair for that type of thing. Yeah, even selling Paul Masson Chenin Blanc or whatever is just, yeah, that the kind of, yeah, the twilt of the head and the arch of the eyebrow. It's like, you know, who else can do that type of thing as well as Orson Welles, you know? So yeah, appreciate it and dig it for what it is. I like those touches, and I think he was actually very well employed in this film. And the presence of somebody like with his kind of larger than life persona, as well as Jack Nicholson. And again, Tuesday Weld, I think, you know, she's not somebody who's going to be regarded in the same league as far as, you know, all-time cinematic legends as either Nicholson or Wells. But I did a little bit of reading up on her, and she's an interesting personality, to say the least. We've already remarked on her beauty and her, you know, just kind of her presence. But she really could have been a major star. She could have been at the level of, you know, Anne Margaret, Raquel Welch, or others. You know, she very willfully did not want that type of a career. Faye Dunaway, exactly. And you know, she's still alive. She's been a bit reclusive in recent decades, and you know, you get a sense of there's a lot of sorrow and even tragedy behind the surface there, because she was you know, a child actor from very early on, and you know, she was apparently offered a part in Stanley Kubrick's Lolita, you know, as the main character. She says, "I didn't need to play it. Right. I was Lolita." And it's like, yeah, you can just sort of fill in the blanks as far as what that experience may have been like. So another a very intriguing character. I believe, looking at her biography, she had either was coming through a divorce or had just emerged from one. So she was at a real crossroads in her own life at this time as well. Yeah, so some very interesting personalities, you know, giving their input on this project.
Definitely, yeah.
There's a great Dick Cavett interview you can find online with Tuesday Weld that she did at the time that this film was released.
Oh, I'll have to look that up. Yeah.
Yeah, it's just our luck, because I looked for an interview and that was the only one.
Okay.
But it's the whole broadcast, so if you're curious about history, it even has all the commercials. It's amazing.
Oh yeah, that sounds great. Hey, we were going to talk about music. Derek, you're a music guy. Tell us a little bit, what did you think of the soundtrack and all these kind of standards? I think these were actually played from the 78 platters that Jaglom had collected.
Oh, that's right. I was trying to remember, like, the soundtrack. Oh yeah, a whole bunch of
Lemaire and of,
French
Lavender,
yeah,
Blue,
French ballads, yeah.
and Someone to Watch Over Me,
yep,
all that stuff, right?
Yeah, exactly. I could tell that these were all very, very personal songs, and Jaglom definitely talks about that this was something, it was because of his family coming over from Europe, and you know it was like a piece of home that they could kind of carry with them. So there's a personal attachment that he intuned and then kind of adopted it as his own. I also remember seeing that one of the criticisms was just the overuse of Lemaire. It's like, why do these songs keep coming up all the time? But I can also understand that if the film is supposed to be really kind of the point of view of Susanna's thought process, you know, music is a fixation. In fact, it's the thing that always strikes me is when you read about Alzheimer's and dementia and memory loss, the last thing that is retained is music that you heard around, not quite your childhood, but like, I think somewhere around like 8 or 10 mm-hmm. or so, mm-hmm. but you remember that music very vividly, even when everything else is gone. Mm. So in a way, I treat those songs, they're not my personal choice, and I know that's not for everybody's, but it's the idea that this is something really, like, this speaks to her, this gets at the core of who she is, and by hearing it, you kind of know a bit about her and what drives her, what she wants, and all those things. You know, that music conveys so elegantly mm-hmm. at times, because just for that moment, you have all of the various sensations and emotions that music can provide. So,
yeah, I think Jagalom talked about, you know, he focused on songs that made him weep, you know, that kind of brought the tears to his eyes. And Lemaire, even after putting it on, you know, constant rotation, just, you know, reduced him to tears every time. So, there is a sentimental tug to that song, even again, if it's not your period of music or you didn't grow up with it. There is a sweetness and sentimentality really to all of these songs. If you kind of go back to the golden age of crooners and that kind of thing. Jordan, any thoughts on the soundtrack?
I mean, I was very aware both times I watched it, how pervasive it was. I don't think I would miss it if the songs were gone. I don't think that they work in the same way that the rock anthems, you know, Born to Be Wild, make the scenes in Easy Rider like really come to life. I don't feel like the musical contributions here are essential for me in the same way. So, and maybe it has to do with that these are 1940 songs that I really don't have a personal connection to. Maybe that's part of it. But since they're also sort of very soft and tender, I think they recede very easily into the general fabric of the film. I think they help for continuity of attention, especially since the editing is jumping around. So I think structurally what it does is it gives, you know, all of that editing something to land on, to help hold it together. But I don't really feel like it enhances my journey through this.
Yeah, I think if this is Jagalom kind of tunneling into his own memories and in his own personal feelings rather than tapping into the zeitgeist like Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper did when they got Steppenwolf and the other kind of rock and roll soundtrack going. They obviously were into those songs themselves, but they knew that this spoke pretty powerfully to a whole generation, you know.
I've learned
through other instances that music choice in films is very often very subjective, and what you may find as very personally moving and emotive and tragic and does everything that you want it to do, to most other people it just may come off as a complete joke, or they laugh it off, or they say, what is this? This is utter trash, or whatever it is. So it and especially for something like this, because it's inherently so subjective, I can understand that it cannot work for everybody right off the bat. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, like as a painter, they say don't use family photo albums as source material, because you have no objectivity. You don't know what these photos are because you see them through a very specific lens. It's like, you know, Jagalom filming his childhood apartment. I am so distracted by the opulence, you know, that I have no access to what he thought he was doing there in terms of tenderness and sentimentality.
Yeah, and if it had not been such a remarkable environment with all the art, with all the, you know, bric-a-brac, it would have been extremely self-indulgent. What if he had just grown up as a middle-class kid in New Jersey or Long Island or something like that?
Yeah.
But I want to show my parents' little suburban ranch house, you know, like, big whoop, you know.
Yeah, the Sears starter home.
Right. Would have been more universal than the study with the Renoir.
I guess to his credit, Jagalom is saying, you know, I've had a interesting, unique life. He's not, well, I guess in some ways he's flaunting it. He's saying, check this out. He's putting out there his art. But I think, you know, his motives are defensible at the very least. So I think we've done a pretty good job of covering this film. Any final points or observations that either of you would like to make before we wind her down?
Again, I just like the audacity. I can, even if I don't like a film or if it doesn't speak as strongly to me, I always appreciate when someone has the audacity just to make something that they want to make. And so at least you get a window into how they see the world. And I think that's what's amazing about cinema in general. And that's why I try to be as adventurous as I possibly can, to just to see as many different vantage points as I can. So it's so if I whether I like the film or not is irrelevant, but I'm glad that there is a safe place out there.
Yeah, and I'm you know, certainly glad that the American filmmaking industry had this opening. Obviously Henry Jagulum, coming out of the theatrical world, saw his moment. He went for it, and even though he's not far from a household name, he seems to have established a pretty good career. And you know, if nothing else, you got to admire an artist who does a lot of work on his own terms over the course of a long period of time. So I definitely will be looking into some of his features that are available on Prime Video. And again, you can check out the links and maybe take the journey a little bit further. It doesn't seem likely that he's destined to have any other releases make it into the Criterion Collection, but who knows? Maybe on the channel one of these days they'll bring him on over, because he certainly, you know, from what I can see with his personality and his independent streak, seems to fit into the broader categories of what Criterion is all about. So maybe this isn't the last of Henry Jagulum that we'll see under that Criterion logo. Jordan, got any final thoughts before you wrap things up?
I think one last observation thematically I'd just throw in at the end here, just because it's somewhat, it's one of those thematic points that doesn't get hit on the head, is that her name is Noah. One of the gifts that she get is from the magician is an ark, mm-hmm. and there's a rainbow, mm-hmm. and
right.
there's not a lot of additional kind of emphasis on this, but I would say that I think it adds this really dark interpretation of that, the fable of Noah's Ark and the flood, that really hardly anyone made it out alive. Like, it's right, an extremely right. genocidal event, you know, where like survival is very rare. It's a very rare thing. And our character probably doesn't survive her journey.
Yeah.
And I feel like that's probably the point of that. It's the best I can do
yeah.
With the theme.
Well, how about the name of the film itself? I mean, I never heard the words "a safe place." Maybe I missed it. Let me know if I'm wrong.
No.
But it seems like an odd choice of a title. I don't know that I have a better title in mind, but this isn't exactly a safe film by any means. You know, there's danger. There's you know, at least hints of suicide and loss and tragedy and risk and vulnerability. So is a safe place kind of an ironic? Is it an in-joke? Is it what Noah/Susan is looking for? Is what
I think it's childhood.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, maybe.
I think it's certainly something she aspires to have. And I think in the beginning, you kind of get the sense she may have found it, but then at the same time, she's also seeking it out and trying to, you know, like hold on to
yeah.
it. And then by the end of it, she may have found it, but she probably had to do an exit in order to do that. So.
Yeah. Kind of fitting with that get back theme. The Beatles obviously were focusing on that around this time. And that back to nature, back to the simplicity, mm-hmm. you know, end of the '60s and the hippie dream and all of that. I don't know.
Or just escape from the harshness mm-hmm, of reality, mm-hmm. which makes me think of Brazil, like what happens to Sam Lowry at the end.
Yeah.
So.
All right. Well,
and in terms of the irony, yeah, you know, utopia, there's no such place. You know,
mm-hmm.
you
exactly. It's nowhere.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, an apartment overlooking Central Park isn't that bad.
That's you know,
pretty,
as
that's
a backup plan.
All right, guys. Well,
as long as you have your Degas and Chagall hanging up, that's all I
that's
need.
That's right, yeah. And the investment portfolio raking in its dividends. It's all good. All right, guys. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation. Hopefully this will maybe encourage listeners who haven't checked out A Safe Place in a while to give it a fresh set of eyes, or maybe set aside some of the pan reviews that you've seen and get into it. So thank you for enlarging and enhancing my opinions and assessment of this film, Derek and Jordan. It's been good having you back on the show again, and we look forward to picking up the conversation sometime soon.
Pleasure.
Can I plug
always.
Something before we sign off?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, give us any little updates. What are you up to? What kind of news or tidbits you want to share with our listeners?
Well, assuming the coronavirus doesn't cancel all public events,
yeah.
On the 25th of April, I will be performing at the San Francisco Arts Fair with a group called the Factronauts, and I will be playing a version of Trump.
Okay.
Interesting.
Okay. You going to be wearing a padded suit, can I ask?
It won't be like an SNL impersonation, but okay. I will, it's a spoken word piece.
A demagogue, basically. You'll be,
I've created a spoken word piece out of transcripts of his various speeches.
Oh, so okay.
That's, yeah. Yeah, should be good.
Okay,
should
well, I'm not sure I'll be able to make it out there next month, but hopefully there will be some well, I know, but got to be realistic here, but hopefully there'll be some kind of a recorded artifact that we can check out. So wish you all the best for that, and I do definitely hope that that this dreaded contagion doesn't slow down life to a crawl across our culture.
Right.
Derek, any other news or announcements you want to make, projects you're working on?
Really, I think the best single place to get in touch with everything that I have out there is if you go to djproject.cc, which is actually taking advantage of the Linktree feature. So it has links to everything. So it links to my Facebook, it links to Twitter, it links to my music projects through different avenues, and really it's just the best single place to go to find out everything that I'm doing and I'm interested in and what I want to show off.
Excellent. So. Okay. Well, I'll make sure that link is in the show notes. So until next time, where we will again keep the BBS conversation going with the Last Picture Show. This is David Blakeslee signing off. Thanks for listening in, everybody. We'll see you next time. Goodbye.
La mer qu'on voit danser le long du golfe clair a des reflets d'argent, la mer, des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer, au ciel d'été, confond ses blancs moutons avec les anges si purs, la mer. Bergère d'azur infinie, voyez près des étangs ces grands roseaux mouillés, voyez ces oiseaux blancs et ces maisons rouillées. La mer les a bercés le long des golfes clairs et d'une chanson d'amour, la mer a bercé mon cœur pour la vie.